Welcome to the NOVA-sponsored session on education and knowledge building in animal agriculture. I'd like to just take a few minutes. My name is Scott Hine with Novus International. Take a few minutes to introduce the panel members just by name, and then I'll hand over to Thad Simons, our CEO, to tell you a little bit more about Novus. To my right is Mr. Raji. He's from Nigeria. He's going to do a little small introduction on himself, so I won't spend the extra time. Mr. Abdul Razak from Kenya, Dave Harlan from Cargill, Sergio Belver, he's also from Novus International, but works specifically in our Africa region, and Dr. Jerry Nelson, he's going to moderate the panel. What we've got today is a little bit different. It's not a presentation format, but this is a panel. The intention of the panel is to provide much like a kitchen table conversation so that we get some issues on the table, we start to get some things going, some discussion and some debate, and bring out the salient points about what the real issues in animal agriculture and education and how they're linked, especially with respect to growth of that industry in Africa. With that, I'd like to hand it over to Thad Simons. He'll tell you a little bit about Novus International, and then we'll move straight into the discussion.
Thank you, Scott, and thank you all for joining us. It's very good to see so many people turning out for this this session that we have. I think it's as CCA was putting this together and approached us, we were all a little concerned that whether people would take the time and focus, but as we heard already in the plenary session this morning, this is really the right time to be looking in terms of investing in agriculture in Africa. And we at Novus are also moving in that direction, and Sergio will be able to talk about that as well, or we have other people here in the audience from Novus, and we're very much happy to be a part of this day. As I just wanted to give you a little bit of a commercial on Novus. Since we're the sponsor, we get to have the little commercial here. So to tell you our company, so we're owned by two Japanese companies, Mitsui, a very large trading company. They're involved in many activities all around the world, and Nippon Soda, a chemical company in Japan. Our sales are nearly $1 billion, and we're focused on animal nutrition and health products, and we have about 350 employees around the world. That's not very big. Each one of them is really very important in our organization, and they're actually working out of more than 20 different countries. And probably less than half of them are in the United States, actually. But unfortunately, so far, we don't have a single person in Africa, but that will change very soon. And we have over 2,000 customers in more than 80 different countries, and we are selling through distributors into some African countries. We have our own corporate vision, and it's really tied to our position in the food industry. We provide nutritional supplements, so amino acids, organic acids, minerals, different kinds of products that help to make the food better and help to preserve the quality of the food, primarily for animal production. We're all about the customer, and the customer comes first in our list of core values and comes second in terms of making sure we demonstrate the value. And that is also tied back into our technology base. We're based in St. Louis, and in St. Louis we have a research center where we do research with regard to animal nutrition. But that goes beyond that. We have research collaborations with universities and research institutes all around the world. Act with integrity is very important to us, and we expect that from all of our employees. And we take it deeper in terms of protecting the employees, the public, and the environment. Sustainability for us has always been a part of what we're looking to do, and seeking excellence from employees is a way in which we work with our employees to make sure that the opportunities for growth and development are there. We are global, as I mentioned. We have a sales force and technical people around the world. We have PhD nutritionists and vets on staff in St. Louis and research, but we also have them stationed all around the world to support our customers around the world. And increasingly, our research is going outside. We have announced recently that we're starting a research center in Vietnam that's focused on aquaculture, because that's a very important, fast-growing industry in Asia, and certainly I understand a lot of opportunity for development in Africa. And we have a global university network where we work with many different universities and all across the world. We're able to move products from the U.S. abroad, yes, but also increasingly we're sourcing products from around the world and moving them from one part to another. and we market our products everywhere. Our products are around advanced health and nutrition needs, so really looking in terms of how we can maximize the efficiency of production, allowing the animals to grow to their genetic potential. And we have this, and we understand the differences in different feedstocks, and looking in terms of the increasing grain prices we have today, we have tools that we can use in working with our customers to help them to improve the efficiency and profitability of their businesses. We are very focused on food safety and environment, and many of our products will actually reduce the customer's cost of production, improve their efficiency, and reduce the environmental impact. We do sell to major producers of animal protein, people like Tyson and Smithfield, but we also sell at very farmer level. We sell to farmers in Thailand that have their own ponds for their own aquaculture. So we sell at all different levels of the value chain. I mentioned the scientific basis of our company and the application of that to our products. This is kind of a snapshot of our product line. So basically the first group of amino acids are primarily around methionine. It's an essential amino acid that goes into animal production, primarily into poultry, because poultry needs it in their diet because of the feathers. I won't get any more technical than that, but it's very much needed in terms of poultry diets everywhere in the world. We have a line of organic acids, which would be all tied to health. How can we grow the animals in a healthy way and minimize the use of drugs? And this business has really been driven out of the needs in Europe, but increasingly it's concerned in other parts of the world. And we have also a vaccine for coccidiosis, which is a parasite that attacks chickens. And we have a vaccine. So again, this is really focused on health through nutrition, using good nutrition, and being able to minimize the amount of drugs in your program. We have a line of minerals. Again, mineral nutrition is often overlooked in terms of the importance it has on bone strength and skin integrity. And this is an area where we can work with customers really to focus on improving the quality of their animals. It can also be important in terms of animal welfare, because these are some of the indicators of poor conditions for animals if they have broken bones or cut skin. At the bottom, in Steadfast, we've recently launched a group of products in the United States for the equine industry. And this is something which is new for us to sell directly to consumers. So here we're selling directly to the horse owner, rather than most of our products are sold through feed mills and come to the farmer most often through the feed mill. We have a line of feed quality products, which are basically preservation in terms of antioxidants, preventing oxidation of the feed, oxidation of the fish meal, and also products that prevent mycotoxins, so mold inhibitors, or that will actually bind the mycotoxins if they're there. And those are the last products in terms of the Solus and Prostabil Captura. These are products that really help to control the quality, stop the mold from growing, capture the toxin if it's there. And then we have specialty products, which are more into enzymes and yeast and products that help to more specialized needs for customers. So as I said, it's really about growing. Performance is paramount. We don't have enough food really in the world. We need to improve the performance. We've already heard this morning about the opportunities in Africa for improving the performance level. But at the same time, we want to do this in a way that is sustainable, that recognizes the needs for animal well-being, for the environment, and providing safe and secure food for everyone in the world. So that is what we're trying to achieve, and we like to try to work with customers in achieving their goals. So that's a little bit of in a few slides, Novus. So I'll turn it over to Jerry, I think, at this point, to if there are any more introductions that are needed, or to get to kick off the discussion.
Thank you. I think we'll make a quick introduction, and then we'll get on with the discussion. As he indicated, I'm Jerry Nelson at the University of Missouri. My background is mainly on plant agriculture, but particularly on forages and livestock production, working with pastures and forage quality, as well as some plant physiological issues. Mr. Sergio Belver.
My name is Sergio Belver. I was born in Zaire. I've lived all my childhood in Africa, more than 17 years. I am a veterinarian by formation. I did my Master of Science at Cornell University here in the States. And while I was pursuing my PhD, Novus and my life and Novus joined, and since then I've been working with Novus. I started as a technical service manager for Southern Europe, then passed to sales manager for Spain. And as the opportunities for markets appeared in Africa, given my experience, I have been working in the last 9 years trying to develop some markets in Africa.
And I'm Dave Harlan with Cargill. Few of you may have heard about Cargill. We are a privately held corporation, one of the largest privately held corporations in the U.S. And we are an international provider of food, agricultural, and risk management products and services around the world, with about a little over 150,000 employees, predominantly outside the United States, or the majority outside the United States. And we currently operate in about 63 countries where we actually have offices or businesses. A little bit about myself, and I feel somewhat of a newcomer to Africa issues, so I'll tell you that right out front. My background was as an animal nutritionist. That's what I was trained in. Went to work for the feed industry, and then a meat packing plant on the rendering side. And in the 90s, got involved in BSE or mad cow disease issues and the policy and the science of that. And in 2002, the Cargill Corporation acquired the company that I was in. And at the time, I thought, oh no, this is a big company buying us up, end of my career. But it's turned out completely different. Soon after BSE was found in Canada, I was pulled into a role working across Cargill on this issue. And that evolved into all animal health issues. So I'm not a veterinarian, but my current role is focusing on animal health policy issues in a very broad sense across the globe. So I work on capacity building and helping to try to coach the leaders at Cargill on where the opportunities are relative to animal health, predominantly in the meat and poultry and egg production systems. I should say my experience in Africa is limited. For part of my master's in public health degree, which I recently completed, I created a project in Mozambique working with Techniserve. Many of you may know of Techniserve as an NGO, and got Cargill to fund it. And we were looking at animal health capacity building with the government of Mozambique, and hopefully that project will continue to move forward, either with or without me. So my experience in Africa is two-week trips specifically to Mozambique. That, when I later share my thoughts and experiences, I just wanted you to know that's how limited I am. Thank you.
Yes.
My name's Shaukat Abdul Razak. I'm a Kenyan, born, brought up in Kenya. I went to school, of course, in Kenya, and I did my undergraduate in animal husbandry from Egerton University. Egerton University is the oldest institution of higher learning in Kenya, having started in 1939 as an institute offering certificate in agriculture, and then it evolved to start offering diplomas a few years later after that, until 1986-87. It started offering degree programs. It is basically an agricultural-based university, but now we've expanded. We have various other disciplines as well. After my undergraduate studies, I went to Aberdeen University in Scotland. I did both my master's and PhD in animal science and majored in animal nutrition, more specifically ruminant nutrition. My interests have been on the utilization of locally available feed resources to improve livestock in Kenya and in Africa or tropic in general. I've worked at Kenya Agriculture Research Institute. I've also been seconded and worked at International Livestock Research Institute, ILRI, formerly ILCA. I've also worked in the Ministry of Agriculture and also as a lecturer at Kilifi Institute of Agriculture in the coastal Kenya. And then I moved to my former university, Egerton University, and I started teaching there about 13 years ago. I moved to the ranks of becoming a chairman of department, acting dean, and last 6 years I was promoted to the level of deputy vice chancellor in charge of research and extension. And again recently I was appointed to become the secretary, National Council for Science and Technology within the Ministry of Higher Education, Science and Technology. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
My name is Waliraji. I'm from Nigeria, Lagos State, to be precise. I work for the Lagos State Government. I'm the permanent secretary in the Lagos State Ministry of Agriculture and Cooperatives. I trained as an economist and have an MBA. I've been involved since 1993 in agricultural planning and administration. And in the last 5 years, I've been coordinating extension activities to farmers and the adoption of new technologies in agriculture in Lagos State, which it happens to be the most populous state in Nigeria and the commercial nerve center of Nigeria. Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you, panel. As you can tell, we have a very diverse panel with a range of geography as well as expertise in different areas of animal agriculture, which offers an interesting challenge all the way around. The focus today is on animal agriculture and education. We heard some things this morning about the issues in marketing. We also heard about issues relative to grain prices and so on. All of these are very important in animal agriculture area. And the question is, how can we then work with companies to develop technologies or in other ways to develop straight education programs? So that will be the focus on education, animal science advancement in Africa, mainly on sub-Saharan Africa, to keep it a little bit more focused. We distributed some questions that revolve around some issues. We're not going to be able to give the complete answers, but we wanted to give you a glimpse of some of the issues that are associated with each of those questions, and then we'll leave some time at the end, providing my panel makes their responses very short, so we can have some questions from the audience to pursue into a little bit more detail. Starting out somewhat with the political issues, Mr. Belvar, and we'll get some other responses as well, there's been a long effort, or a lot of effort, by NGOs and other organizations to help in Africa. What lessons have we really learned from those experiences, and where does education fit into that particular matrix of NGOs or institute government relationships?
My my experience with regards to NGOs and international agencies stems from the fact that my father was a FAO specialist and worked for 35 years in development programs in Africa regarding animal health. So I have a perspective, an insider perspective, and also I have the perspective of going back to Africa now after 30 years and experimenting what the result of those actions might have been. The conclusions I have right now is that most of the help that Africa has received from these agencies has been given by the Western model. So to speak, African problem, the Western experts do an evaluation, a budgeting, estimate a program length, an economical budget, a time and a personal and a material involvement, do the project for 2, 3, 5 years, and then hand the project back to the local authorities, and the project after 2, 3 years is gone. What was achieved is not there anymore. Now the question is, how can we change that? And we've been discussing through this group, and I agree with the final conclusion is that we need to find specific African solutions for specific African problems. And this is where education has a big role to play, because for an African to find an African solution, he needs a higher level of education than he has now. Sometimes solutions have been very, very influenced by Westerners. I have a few examples, but for example, animal breeds. It is the typical example of imported animal breeds into Africa, where pathological and nutritional situation cannot make them perform. But there are even more simpler ones, like the fact that I am surprised even today to see that African households don't eat millet. I remember when I was a kid in Africa, millet was the cereal of choice for all African house. Now they prefer corn or wheat because of Western influence. And this is something that, again, that has to do with education. We need to help Africans educate themselves and help Africans feed themselves and understand that they need to use the resources that are really available to them. I think that's basically the vision. Then the other aspects that are more specific to the project is that nothing has been taken into account when you do a project on the long term. Things like spare parts for machinery, things like budget for the long-term planning, things like forming and educating the professionals of the local country who will manage the project years afterwards, has never been taken into consideration. And that's from the part of the agency. From the part of the local government, I have to say there is a lot of corruption. A lot of money that has been gone into Africa for the help has gone to private banks in other countries. I have to say also that politicians, and this is not only characteristic of Africa, have generally a view that stems not more than 4 or 5 years until the next election. So it's very hard for the governments to invest in long-term planning. And I think this is very important, that education has to take consideration not only the people who are affected, but also the people who will implement the policies.
I think you raise a very good point in the fact that the educational component needs to be integrated into the development program so that it can be sustained, probably both at the technical level as well as the professional level, to maintain those things. These are experiences that I've run into as well, and without going into further, I would hope that maybe that would stimulate some questions. A second thing that I would like to raise is that many African countries have now developed a vision for looking at the potentials in agriculture and how they might be related. And I know that there are at least two, and probably most of the African countries, have gone into these long-range planning projects. What is the program that you're looking at in Kenya with your Vision 2030, and how does that fit in a general sense to the rest of Africa?
Thank you. In Kenya, we've been having a lot of government initiatives, like any other government, like what we call national development plans, and probably they will go about five years or around that time. But one of the challenge, as my colleague Sergio did say, is the fact that with all due respect, when the politicians come on board, some of them have what I want to call short-sighted, if you like. They only think about the time when they are in parliament. Now, quite a number of these initiatives have not taken, they have not achieved big things because they tend to set the agenda within that short period of time. But what the government has done in the past, we have a policy on what we call economic recovery strategy for wealth employment creation between 2003, again it ended 2007. Now, that was a very successful policy that saw a ton of events in Kenya where the economy by the year 2002 was somewhere about -2, and 2006 it moved to about 6.5%. As a result of that, the government felt that there's a need now to come with another blueprint that can be able to continue with that initiative. And that's why we started what we call Vision 2030. Basically, Vision 2030 stands on three pillars.
on political, social, and economic aspect. There are quite a number of things under that. Probably we can be able to discuss this further later. But basically, is to see how a sector like agriculture, for example, how we can be able to move or chip in or contribute in Kenya becoming an industrialized nation by the year 2030. To be able to address issues, pertinent issues like, for example, water, science, technology, innovations. That's why the government felt that this is a new initiative, a blueprint that has been put in place. And it has passed through all the stages. It has got its own legal framework and implementation strategy as well. And we are very optimistic that if we are going to follow the path and the roadmap that we've set, this will be a good example for many other countries in Africa that have not taken such initiatives.
Thank you on that. And Mr. Raji, you in Nigeria also has a plan. And what are the similarities or differences in what you're doing?
Thank you very much. Nigeria, as a developing country, we also realize the fact that we need to move with the other developing countries of the world so that we are not left behind. That informed the development of the Vision 2020 in Nigeria, which the main aim of this is to reduce our present dependence on oil as the major foreign exchange earner for the country, and also focus on the real sector, the development of the real sector of the economy, because about not less than about 70 to 75% of the population of Nigeria is involved in agriculture. So attention is now being focused on agriculture, you know, so as to create employment for the people and also to guarantee food security. And electricity supply is a major issue because most of the problems we are facing right now is post-harvest losses in Nigeria, and just like it applies to most other African countries, is enormous. It ranges between 40 to 50%. And lack of inadequacy of electricity supply is a major issue in this. And the efforts, you know, part of the focus of the Vision 2020 is to ensure stable electricity supply in the country. And of course, the government realizing that government is not the best managers of business is now withdrawing, you know, to the background to policy formulation and allowing, you know, the private sector to do what they know how to do best, and that is business. So PPP, public-private partnership, is a major strategy that has been adopted in Nigeria, you know, to drive the economic development of the country. Thank you.
And I think you can sense that at least these two African countries and most of the others are going through a strategic planning mission because, as we know, in the 1970s with the Green Revolution, it sort of passed over without very much impact in Africa. And now there's another opportunity that they really need to take advantage of. But each is a little bit different, and that's unique, again, and a very characteristic of Africa. Moving along a little bit to some economic issues, you mentioned, Mr. Raji, water and electricity as being major issues, and of course energy is a factor that's coming along, and water resources. And can you give us a response on what's happening or what is the situation and how is that so critical to animal agriculture and the development of animal agriculture? Let's go back to our Kenyan friend.
Yes. Right. Let's just go back to this Vision 2030 that I just said earlier. And we reckon that it is very important and actually prudent that unless we put issue of energy the top list of the agenda, we are not going to realize the vision that we have. So in the country, we are taking this very seriously. The issue of water, 80% of Kenya is arsenal, you know, arid and semi-arid areas. And we know that there is water for basic home consumption, water for industries, water for, you know, livestock, which we are actually looking at this point. We feel there is a need for us to be able to put this in training, you know, so that we can be able to come with the personnel that we require to address these issues of energy, the issues of water. Because very often, as much as we would like to talk about geothermal, we want to talk about hydroelectricity, we want to talk about renewable energy, you know, biogas, wind, I must admit that we do not have the personnel to address this. So it is very important from that point of view of education training that, you know, a country like Kenya needs to address. And this is actually indeed, it is in the blueprint that we are going to address in issues of, you know, training so that we can have relevant people who can be able to look at issues of water and issues of energy as well to drive the vision that we have.
Yes, thank you. My own experience tells me a little bit about this as well. And earlier when Mr. Bulver was talking about crops and millet, and one of the things that's going to happen is to move more crops onto dryland agriculture, and millet is one of those that's very, very well adapted. Another point that we need to be concerned about is the is not only the water quality for the humans, but the water quality for animals and its availability. And then extensive ranges, that's another challenge that we need to be dealing with. So I hope that in the 2030 plan and the others that that is something that's taken care of. The other point is the infrastructure. It's not only just addressing specifically agriculture, but the total infrastructure that goes along with it. I want to continue to move along and get into something that was in a discussion earlier this morning. There was a lot of discussion about marketing. And we hear that in animal agriculture over and over and over again, and it wasn't really addressed so much this morning. But what is the role here, and where can improvement in marketing play have an effect on what's happening in animal agriculture, and where does education fit into that?
Okay.
Mr. Harlan, perhaps you can answer.
Sure. You know, the speakers this morning in the plenary session, I think, hit it right on the head of the nail. There's two key words, access and transparency. And if producers don't have access to transparent markets and in a properly functioning system of markets where they both locally tied to that local market and also global markets, the opportunities for them to expand go down. And we look at markets and say the purpose really to the producer is to reduce the risk due to volatility of markets. And this is something where education can play a role because, you know, you have to educate the producers and really the whole family that's involved in agriculture, so both the husband and the wife and even, you know, the older children, that these risk management tools that you use in the commodity exchange markets are not about, you know, capturing the high or, you know, it's about locking in a profit that they can live with and reducing that price volatility. Sometimes you're going to lose because the market's going to shoot higher, but you've captured the median. Sometimes you're going to win because by the time your crop comes to the marketplace to be delivered, the price is going to be down and you're going to be paid higher. This is an issue that's not only, I think, an issue in Africa, it's an issue everywhere, even in the developed world, where producers at times in the past have been reluctant to use these tools to lock in the cost of their inputs and also the value they're going to get from the outputs of their production system. So I think education does play a key role in this. It can be delivered either through extension service, some other lifelong learning programs, the private sector. My bias would be if the private sector, such as a Cargill or the exchange in a country was involved, they would be better to partner with the government Ag Extension Service for credibility purposes. So I think these markets, you know, the ability to reduce price volatility and reduce your risk due to that, I should retrace my words there. There is going to be price volatility in the markets. It probably will get worse in the future. So it's your ability to manage the risk around that, that these marketing systems bring in. So, you know, I saw some of this in my experiences in Mozambique. Michigan State University had people there. Some of the techniques that are now being deployed using text messaging technologies to get information to very remote areas. When we went out in the field and talked to the producers or the local villagers, I mean, this information was critical to them. I don't think it will require massive amounts of education. It's just a, how do you explain how these systems work in simple language and show people and coach them on how to use it. So I think there's many good examples of how this can be done. There's probably also some bad examples in Africa.
Well, no question about it. The marketing is a very important point, and particularly on products such as livestock products that need specific handling and processing in order to really be marketed all the way to, through the food chain. And Mr. Raji, I know you've got some thoughts on the role of industry and perhaps in more in the abattoir slaughter and processing and packaging of animal products. What is the status of that, and where do you see that going, and what role would industry play?
One of the major problems that we are facing in Nigeria, and which I also believe is similar to the experience of other countries in Africa, is the quality, you know, of the products, you know, from coming from the farms, and also the fact that a substantial percentage of what is produced, you know, is lost due to lack of post-harvest, you know, processing. And this is also very applicable. I mean, it's very obvious in the animal, I mean, livestock industry, particularly cattle meat processing, you know, in Nigeria. The quality of the beef, you know, is something that we need to look at, and which also provides investment opportunities for investors. You know, because the way the beef and meat is being processed in the country today, you know, leaves much to be desired, and it also, at the end of the day, affects the income of the farmers. You know, I mean, at the end of the day, because there is no adequate, the proper method, you know, of processing, transportation, storage, and, you know, marketing. So these are areas that if the industry, the industry can come in, you know, one, to add value to the, to the product in the, by ensuring the best practices in the in processing, you know, definitely the quality, the quality of the product at the end of the day will be enhanced. The income of the farmers will be also will increase, and it will be better. And also the investor will also have cause to smile.
Mm-hmm. So. Yes, thank you. I think what you're seeing is that there's an integrated approach in marketing. Not only is it going to take the knowledge and understanding the markets, but it's going to take the infrastructure to get the product to the market in the form that it should be. And this value-added concept is something that's really important and something that could be added with the educational component as we look forward in that area. So we look at the product from the farm on, and as you said before, 40 to 50% of it is lost due to some things, eggs or particularly meat products, and we need to get that worked out a different way. Switching over to some social and cultural issues, how do we look at African agriculture at the farm level? Traditionally, it's been a family farm with a female oftentimes at the head of that. How does that look in the long term? And how is that constraint or factor cultural going to be addressed? Mr. Bolivar, do you have a thought?
Yes. My thought in this line is that if we look at the African panorama today, where about 90% of the arable land is subsistence agriculture, and subsistence agriculture is a family agriculture. Individuals don't need to plow the land. Families do, because families need to feed themselves. So if we want to move, if Africa wants to move from a subsistence agriculture to a more commercial agriculture, there is a very big need for a change. Because, for example, families will grow what they need to feed them with. So it doesn't matter the place where they are. If they are in a very dry area, they will still grow corn. They need to grow what they need for their family. Now, trying to move that to a more operational perspective, so to say, trying to move that for a more group unit, is something that Africa has not been very successful to do until now. I know that education has a lot to do with it, because, for example, most of the surpluses of family production goes to the market, marketed by women, and they are a very important part of the income of African families. So I think education has a lot to do there, in the sense of empowering women and families to make more and to incite them to unite them to make bigger production units. Now, we can call this cooperativism. We have a person in our table here today who is very involved with cooperatives. I think that he could be a better speaker than me. But Africa has a traditional family unit that is very in the tissue, and we need to move from that in order to move from subsistence agriculture to commercial agriculture.
So one of the areas of putting these together would be cooperatives, and I know, Mr. Raji, you've been looking at that in a short sense. How are the cooperatives working, and are there other models that would work in Africa for animal agriculture particularly?
Yes. Those of us who are familiar with the way the cooperative system, works, is to allow small players, to become big players by cooperating among themselves. Small holder farmers, coming together, to produce, and what we have done in Nigeria in that regard is forming them into cooperative societies, and using the cooperative societies as the basis for government contact with them, and that is why in most ministries, most ministries of agriculture in Nigeria, and even at the federal level, you find the cooperative department alongside agriculture department. So that when they come together, they can take advantage of economy of scale in procurement of some of the vital inputs, instead of buying at retail level. They can buy wholesale, and then reduce the unit cost of their input, and this has really worked effectively for them. Mm-hmm. And maybe I should also, since this opportunity, to also mention that many of the intervention programs of the World Bank in agriculture, we have used effectively, you know, the cooperative, the group approach, mm-hmm. you know, to assisting them. For instance, to address the problem of infrastructure, for instance, you know, under a popular program, World Bank assisted program in Nigeria, which is called FADAMA. You know, the main focus of this is to support the farmers with infrastructure like rural roads, infrastructure like water, infrastructure like electricity. You know, this is done as a group, and also the inputs they require, which they acquire through the component called the pilot asset acquisition. You know, all these are procured, you know, in bulk as a group and distributed. So they also use the group method, you know, to in marketing. You know, for instance, in some parts of the country where we have holders, dairy production, for instance, you know, they collect through the cooperative society milk from the small producers, and the cooperative will now process and then market.